and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Bioneers in Alaska Annual Conference, recorded on October 16th. Hear from Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farm in Bethel. His talk entitled Sustainable Agriculture in Rural Alaska is coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farm in Bethel, Alaska. You can see photos of Tim's farm on alaskapublic.org. His talk on sustainable agriculture in rural Alaska was recorded at the Bioneers in Alaska conference held at UAA on October 16th.
So we're ready to start our keynote session here this morning. And I'd like to just pause for a second and give a bit of background about Tim Myers. I'm an Alaska gardener, and I have tried for several years to grow winter squash. It's always been something I couldn't manage. And this year I decided to do a bit of research, and I found out that Tim was using Visqueen, covering with lots of row cover. I decided to try his technique, and it really worked. But I had already known about Tim. I had read about him in the past, and I knew that he was accomplishing things that folks who were experts said simply couldn't be done. Tim had come to Alaska in 1976 after working on his grandparents' dairy farm. He and his wife Lisa have raised four daughters. And he is also a master gardener, having taken the course from Fairbanks. He was also told there in Fairbanks that farming or gardening would not be very successful, if at all, in Bethel. But what Tim discovered, that the soil was actually perfect for growing in Bethel, and he experimented with a variety of techniques to warm the soil. And although he had only intended to grow food for his family, he rapidly found out that he could do much more than that. Last year, Tim raised about 8,000 pounds of potatoes, 10,000 pounds of leeks, onions, peppers, cabbage, artichokes, and even turkey. And as tribute to some of the background that he's able to supply produce elsewhere, he's built into the hillside of his farm, he's built a root cellar where last year he stored 17,000 pounds of vegetables, and this year apparently hopes to have about 50,000 pounds of vegetables overwintering. And something unique to what Tim has discovered is that as a result probably of the excess coldness, the chilliness that the vegetables are exposed to there in Bethel, his vegetables are a lot sweeter. And so when his cabbage and his leek and his artichokes wind up in Natural Pantry, they're just snapped up. People just can't get enough of them. And he feels that this could be a real competitive advantage, shipping elsewhere, maybe to the lower 48. One sign of his success early on was in 2008. I found out that he was one of a very few awardees for the prestigious 2008 Alaska Marketplace Grants. Tim succeeded in winning $30,000 to build up his farm in 2008. And as evidence of his excitement about what he was doing, I found out that in 2010 he went to the Delta Farm Forum. And he decided to entitle his presentation, "You Won't Believe What I Think I Have Found." So Tim believes that where he lives in Bethel is one of the richest soil areas in the United States. And from his website, I'd like to just quote one viewer who wrote on his web, "I think the Tim Myers farm will do for ag what Copper River Reds did for Alaska salmon." So it's my pleasure to welcome Tim Myers.
Well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate coming and doing this. It sounds a little bit far-fetched what I'm doing, but it's really worked well for me out there, and I see tremendous potential. There's so much talk of food security in Alaska, and you look around the state and think it's just going to materialize And that's a topic that seems to continually come up, but no one's really addressing what are we going to do, except we got to do something. And I think I have a real viable solution looking at the area where we live and seeing the fertility of the ground and the availability of natural fertilizers and the transportation connections out of there. We could really jump on the bandwagon, I would think, and start bringing food security to Alaska in focus, but it's all up to me to do by myself. So here we'll go. This is originally what I started with, 3.5 acres. I brought these two photos, new aerial photos of what I'm doing that were just taken last month, but I don't have the technology of getting them on the screen. I was hoping we could see these, but you'll see in this recent photo the property going off to the right there. There's another 4.5 acres that I just purchased last summer. And I've totally already developed and put this root cellar on there. And I've got much more growing area than what I had last year. And this next photo is property I leased out by the Bethel Airport. DOT had land around the airport, and they looked through their bylaws, and lo and behold, you can lease airport property for agriculture projects. And for grazing cattle, you would pay $5 an acre a year. For growing crops, you'd pay $50 an acre a year. So I've leased 10 acres there. This is which of about 3 acres, and this new photo, you can see where I've now expanded another 5 or 6 acres of it that I'll probably be able to plant most of next year. So I'm really getting to the point where I can start increasing production and producing a lot more crops, having some ground finally. So, you know, it all sounds so phony until I was doing this and everybody would come and look at what I'm doing, and it's like, well, what are you doing to the soil? What are you doing to the soil? Well, I was tilling the soil and putting seeds in the ground and everything, putting this plastic up. It just grows really well. You go without the plastic, and basically you got about an 80% chance of getting nothing, and you put plastic over the top of these crops, and they basically explode. So I found this National Geographic. This is September 2008. The title on the cover is Where Food Begins, and it talks about how we're feeding about 11 billion people on about 6 or 7% of the Earth's surface. And in the middle of the article, it's got this world map, and it shows the world in fertility. So the legend here is on the left, the dark green areas are highly fertile ground, the light green areas are highly fertile ground at risk, and the yellow is marginal fertility. So it's always interesting. I look at Australia, and it's basically yellow with some light green. There's a little bit of dark green or fertile ground down in Tasmania. And I'm assuming the yellow is marginal fertility. Everybody's growing with fertilizers, but very little organic or natural growing happening on that type of land. And you look up at Europe, it's the same thing. Europe doesn't have a lot of good fertile ground. You know, they grow lots of food. I don't know if they're doing a lot of organic stuff or if people have spent the money to improve that marginal fertile ground into organic. Ireland and Scotland have some dark green, so I'm sure they're farming differently there. But looking at the United States, west of the Mississippi, there are lots of good fertile ground, and it's actually probably the biggest section on our planet with good fertile ground. But you look at Alaska, and there's two areas of good fertile ground, and that's the Kuskokwim Valley and Bristol Bay, both of which have zero agriculture in them. So interesting enough for people wanting to get into agriculture, you look around on the world or on the planet, where would be a good spot? I think this might be the last good fertile ground on our planet that's really never had any agriculture on it. You know, and I was just thinking the other day, I've now opened up 17 acres in the last 3 years. Now, this is virgin, pristine ground, never grown, never had DDT. You see all these organic farms popping up down in the States. Well, you know, 20 years ago, they were using things on that ground that wouldn't make them organic, and everybody's converting them back to organic, but this is truly organic soil. And using the fish off the river, I don't know, I see a lot of potential out there for growing lots of food. So here we go. I was in construction for, I went to Bethel in 76. I was a commercial pilot for a while. Then I got into construction. I built lots of different dwellings. I got into building commercial buildings. And the uniqueness that I had doing this, I basically did it all myself. And then I basically kept all these structures and maintained them myself as rentals for 20 years in that environment. So I really learned a lot about how to build a more efficient, more maintenance-free type house. And I started building, I got a building system now that I build everything with steel tubing. I make these structures out of steel. And started with a few of these buildings and these greenhouses is a steel frame I build with a couple layers of plastic and inflate it, put it on the ground. You can see some air pipes in front of that greenhouse there, and I run these pipes through the beds, putting insulation on the ground first, running these air pipes, putting a couple feet of dirt on top of it. So typically, most of the greenhouses, they all get too hot when the sun comes out, and they all have windows and louvers that open to get rid of the heat. Well, I got fans that come on and take most of that surplus heat, and it blows it through this pipe system in the beds and then outside. So early in May, I've got these beds plenty warm to be planting cucumbers and tomatoes in, and I'm typically been harvesting cucumbers out there by June 1st in these greenhouses with these heated beds. And so, and I just keep stumbling upon all these ideas that work well. I've been building these structures now, and really the only reason I've been able to succeed in what I'm doing here is because I've got the courage to build these buildings and down in the ground now. I've got my growing rooms down in the ground where I can easily heat them. If you did it above ground, it would never be able to do it. I've got the barn down in the ground where I can keep birds and everything. It doesn't take any heat. I've got this root cellar down in the ground now. It's pretty interesting. Well, yeah, I used to say underground, but I really gotten to the point that I don't want to say underground because it takes too much engineering to carry the weight of 2 feet of dirt on top of your structure. So even this root cellar now, it's got 12-foot high ceilings, and it's buried up to 12 feet. And then I've got insulation on top and finally put a finished cover on it this year. So it's really not buried. And I have this vision of building houses that would be in the ground, probably a three-story house with, let's stick with the bedrooms on the third floor. We got our egress windows above ground. I'd hate to try to go through the building codes trying to get an egress window in the ground. So we'll do the third floor sticking out of the ground. So we got our egress windows. That's the majority of the code that I would be happy with. And the rest of the building would be very, very, very easy to live in. You know, just on a note there that I'm talking about this, everything in Bethel is, and everything basically in the bush, is above ground. And that was a real novel concept years ago when the early Moravians got there and fuel was 28 cents a gallon and lumber was available. Everybody started building above ground. And when we hit $3 a gallon, $4 a gallon here a few years ago, it really started to think, what the heck are we doing? And I was starting to put things on the ground at that time and finding out that my fuel consumption was way down. And now we went up to $6.18 a gallon just the other day. You look at 100 gallons a month, which is probably less than, or more, well, people are burning more than that, probably more than 100 gallons a month to heat their homes. So we're looking at over $600 a month just for heat. And I bet you we're going to be at 10 here real soon. And I'm thinking, man, if we're going to stay out there, we need massive subsidies just to stay warm. And here I think if we started building our houses like I'm doing here down in the ground, you could basically cut your fuel in half. I'll bet you could cut your electric in half. I'll bet you could cut the cost of building by a third. And we might have a future there. Otherwise, I don't know where the money's going to come from to keep us all out there. You know, and now fuel went up, so the cost of electricity is going up because they're burning fuel. They deliver water to everybody's house with fuel, so if water and sewer's going up, everything goes up. Food's going up. It's unbelievable. And there's no jobs there. So here again, underground, this is how I start all my plants in the spring. I just got a bunch of little T8 4-foot fluorescent lights. I can put four flats of plants under each of those lights, and I start a lot of my stuff in February, March, April. By April, we're able to be moving stuff out into the greenhouses, which is attached to this room. When the sun's up in the morning, then we put them back in there at night, and that way it doesn't require any heat to keep the stuff going. This isn't very good, but there you can see a compost pile that's steaming. This was a couple years ago. That's the one thing I need to really do a lot more of is composting, but there's not enough materials to do it there. I've really kind of even fading from it. I started raising chickens and turkeys, and they're eating everything that I used to compost. There's no carbon source through the summer to be putting with my plant material to be composting. I started doing wood chips for a while, and I wish I could, because that would be great. We have so few of them out there. But I need to do a lot more composting. Definitely egg production is good. People want eggs. I think there's more than enough market. I'd love to have 150, 200 birds. So I do everything in raised beds. I know there's pictures here. I've got a big 40-horse tractor with a 58-inch tiller, and I built this steel box that bolts on the back of the tiller, so as I'm tilling, it makes these rows. And I've got another piece of equipment I built that I can put lime and fishbone meal on and different things on the soil. And then I'll till them one more time and wrap them in plastic and plant them and put up tunnels. Here's that, I'm getting these beds ready to plant now. I'd probably put lime on and fishbone meal. I'll lay drip lines in those grooves, cover them up. Early in the spring now, I'm covering them with plastic, but I've gotten even away from that. Once I get them to this point and plant and put tunnels up, everything's pretty good to go. We did about 5 miles of rows like this spring. Started putting seeds in the ground this year. I've never done that. When I started a few years ago, it was, well, I got it made. I'll just start all my starts, put everything out when they're a month old, and that was cool. But we were putting seeds in the ground in June this year and harvesting broccoli and cabbage in the fall. And we put a lot of seeds in the ground on May 1st and did well with that too. So I can see that's sure going to make things a lot easier next coming years. So after we plant them, we run along the rows with this little handmade plow, and it makes a groove, and we stick these wires in, and we got a rack with the plastics on, and stretch plastic out and bury the edges, and it's pretty easy. Well, I started with PVC, and it was a few years ago, PVC was pretty reasonable. You could go to Home Depot and get it for under 50 cents of it for a 10-foot stick, a half inch. But it's kind of hard. You can't poke it in the ground, so you got to drill holes. And the industry has these number 9-gauge wires that you buy that are bendable and reusable and really much more inexpensive and much simpler. You can poke them in the ground where you don't have to drill. And it's just a number 9-gauge wire. And I'm a finalist again for this Alaska marketplace here next week. And there's a machine that will put these wires in the ground and make the tunnels for you. You just pull it behind the tractor and it's going to be able. And we've got typically these rows here probably 125 feet long, and you can put plastic on a row that long, but these ones we have out at the airport are 200 and 300 feet long. It just would be ridiculous to try to do those by hand. So we're pretty excited about getting a water wheel planter where we can plant these much longer rows and then start covering them like with this machine. Well, in a lot of the rows, doing it early, we put plastic on the ground prior to putting the plants in, which really helps with the weeds. And then it's just a matter of leaving it to the point in July or so where the plants are so big that they can't be under the plastic anymore, and you got to open it up, and we just hand weed. I've got sections now, the older sections that require a lot of weeding, and pretty much all this new ground at this point doesn't have any weeds in it yet, so I'm a little scared when that changes, but volunteers, I guess. Pardon me? Here on this property, this first farm I showed you was, there's a creek that runs right by the bottom. I got a pump in there, and I've got all these 500-gallon tanks that I put up on about four or five pallets by every garden piece and run drip lines and header hoses. I think you can see that header hose laying right there, that blue hose. Fill the tanks frequently, turn the valve on, and everything gets watered at once. It's really easy to do. Real easy to do. So this was, I remember, a couple of years ago, mid-June, cabbage plants. We were selling cabbage that spring. By June 20th, we had beautiful heads of Napa and green cabbage. Well, they were from seed probably in 1st of April. And we probably put those out the first part of May. So they were still freezing. I've learned you can put that stuff out in early spring, and freezing those little plants doesn't really affect it. I don't, you know, it may if they weren't covered with plastic, but I put a lot, 1,000 cabbage out this spring on May 1st, and we had very hard frost until about May 8th. And those plants, if you would have touched them in the morning, they would have broke, and they all survived and did real well. So the frost has got a lot of effect on them in the fall, but it doesn't seem to affect them near as much in the spring. Bought a really nice little cedar and do a lot of stuff by seed now, and gonna do a lot more. So we just do miles and miles of this stuff. No, it's so inexpensive. You buy a 2,500-foot roll, a 6-foot-wide perforated plastic is like $96. And it costs about $50 to get it to us. It'd be quite a bit less, I'm sure, to get it here to Anchorage. But surprisingly enough, if you go to Home Depot and buy a piece of visqueen, it's kind of ouch. But this agriculture stuff, even the drip tape I'm using, a 7,500-foot roll, that's a mile and a half of this drip tape's like $156. So, you know, I kind of, especially out at the airport, I save these 300-foot pieces thinking you're going to reuse them. But when it comes time to reuse them in the spring, the amount of time it would take to untangle them and stretch them back out versus just setting a new roll up and pulling them out, you can't even begin to think of reusing it. I imagine on a smaller scale you would be able to do that, but boy, when we did probably 10 miles of that stuff. If we did 5 miles a row and we got two pieces of tape in every mile last year, it'd be ridiculous to try to reuse. And I feel bad about throwing it away. It seems kind of wasteful. It's definitely not wore out. It's still functional. It's just too hard to reuse in my situation. It's agriculture plastic. Mechanicaltransplanter.com has all this ag stuff that seems to be the big wholesaler in the country. This is pretty neat. This was tundra last year. I planted it this spring. That's kind of the neat thing too, you know. We're doing this all organic, and you look around for possible agriculture property elsewhere in the state, I think you'd be looking at more than a year to get it open, developed, and planted. And I opened and developed this last fall. We planted it this spring, totally organic, no fertilizer, and we did really well off this virgin ground. And now I was dumping liquid fish on that. I put some on last fall. I put some on this spring. It's just going to get better and better. We're going to be able to grow more and more. Oops. Yeah, onions. A few years ago, it seems like the weather is progressively getting colder. I mean, we had a record cold year this year. We hit 70 degrees once, we hit 60 degrees four or five times. We were actually 40s and 50s all summer, And the best part of the summer in July, we didn't have any sun. And I actually feel like I harvested probably 30 to 40% of what I really wanted to, or what I had planned on with the way I planted. And I'd started doing onions 4 or 5 years ago, and we were getting actual summertime weather that was exciting, and I was doing really good, but they continually get worse and worse, and it was pretty hard this year. Yes, I start those in February. I start everything by seed. I've got a friend out there, there's the only other guy that's doing this, that brings all of his starts in from other places, and he's got pest problems like you wouldn't believe. And I don't have any aphids, I don't have anything, I'm not going to allow anything to come onto our property that's going to have that stuff. And you know, I got these rooms down underground, and by February it's so boring with nothing to do, and I just to be able to go down there and spend time getting this stuff started is, you know, there's I can't see at this point making any money on onions, but it's the only thing I got to do in February, so I might as well get going with it. We started over 6,000 lettuce plants this year, and I started probably on April 1st. I'll do 10 flats at a time every 10 days, 750 plants, and we sold almost all of them. You know, I did this farmer's market, and the store selling lettuce they're bringing in from outside for about $3.85 a head. We're selling this fresh organic stuff for $3 a head, and they're much bigger, really nice stuff. And we sold almost all of them that we started, and next year we'll probably do at least half again as many.
Does the store buy any of your stuff?
No. But I don't want to do that either, you know. They at one point were talking, but they wanted to give me Seattle prices with no freight, and I can't grow that much that I can supply them, and demand for this stuff is unbelievable. And with this root cellar I got and this marketing I've got going with this website, I don't have any problem getting rid of this stuff. This was brand new virgin ground too. I think those are all rutabagas and beets next to it there. They're 125 foot rows. There's probably 500 to 1,000 plants in each row. Storage cabbage, we did 1,000 storage cabbage. Last year I did 750 and we got about 6,000 pounds of cabbage. This year I did 1,000 and we probably got about 4,000 pounds. I mean, it just, nothing really grew this year. Fennel we grew quite a bit of. It was good the last 2 or 3 years I was doing these CSA boxes, and I would just give everybody that was buying a CSA box, throw fennel in there all the time, and I was selling giving a couple hundred of them away. And now we got this produce stand, and people have their choice of what they want, and boy, fennel's not a big seller. It grows good. Believe it or not, it's just like a weed. I mean, it doesn't take any care. It grows real easy, but Yeah. Well, my daughter's into that now. She's moved back out there, and she's really helping me, and she's into this food as medicine and teaching people how to deal with this, and it's going to be fun. So I use a lot of fish, and there's a huge source. There's a couple of fish processors that head their fish, gut their fish, then they sell the whole fish here in Anchorage, and they're flying out plane loads of fish, and there's thousands of pounds of fish heads and guts I have available to me. But the state prison also takes the inmates out every day to fish for the prisoners, and they catch 50 to 150 fish a day, fillet them out, and then I get their heads and backbones, which is really what I would rather have than just the heads and guts. And I've got this grinder, and it's really nice. They put them in these super heavy-duty plastic bags. I don't know where they get them, but it's just, I cut the corner out, and I can grind a couple hundred fish in a few minutes. And we grind them into these 55-gallon drums. dump them in these, I got two 2,000-gallon tanks there. And we put water in there, and it's just only by guess how much. And I've got a pond aeration system, a bunch of these little stones that create little tiny air bubbles. And I turn that on in the spring, and we keep adding fish. In about 10 days, the fish has actually broke down to a liquid. And I put molasses in there pretty often to feed the organisms, and then we pump it into other tanks and pump it on our plants. It bubbles like that, and we'll pump out 1,000 gallons and dump another 5 or 6 drums of fish in there and put more water in there and let it bubble, and we'll use the other tank for a while, and I just keep dumping it on. No. You know, rotten fish smells terrible. And I had a guy call me this summer, and he was going to give me some fish scraps. Well, I got quite a bit, but I says, all right, I'll come down and get it. And what had happened, he had got a half dozen fish that went bad, and he had them in a bucket, and he wanted me to have them. And, God, it was terrible to deal with them. And I don't know, you know, they're obviously gone anaerobic already, and I'm adding it to... You know, when I'm grinding this fish, it's only been out of the river an hour. So it's not rotten fish whatsoever. It's just clean heads and guts. And it's got an odor as it breaks down, and you can smell it when I put it on, but it actually just smells like manure. It's hard to tell from animals. I mean, you know, from a dairy farm, it wasn't anything that was much different. And it doesn't smell rotten at all. So... I don't know. It's not offensive to me anymore. But we pump it in these tanks, and we just pump it on everything all the time. So this is a typical harvest. This was when I was doing CSA boxes still last year. We got everything. There's Napa cabbage there. There's broccoli, green cabbage, cauliflower, kale, zucchini, cucumbers, 2 or 3 kinds of turnips, red cabbage, celery, onions, fennel, and that would go into a number of boxes that I was selling on a daily basis. We've done real well with carrots. Carrots did really poor this year, and that would have been weather. Here's our cabbage. I'm speeding up because I got 5 minutes here. So garlic, we did some garlic, quite a bit of garlic. We do it for our own use, but haven't gotten to growing it as a commercial thing yet. Rutabagas do real well. Unbelievably sweet. I grew up on rutabagas in Wisconsin. My mom always boiled them and mashed them, and we eat these raw. We peel them one every night. The texture's phenomenal. They're hard, they're sweet, they're juicy. The schools want me to get involved with this farm-to-school program, and I really see these as snacks for the kids. They're easy to ship around. Turnips, I harvest in these 1,000-pound sacks. Potatoes do real well. So this is that root cellar I built last summer. It's a 40 by 40 building. It's all steel frame. I kind of dug a hole, built this frame down in the ground. There's a 20-foot entryway going back to it. Wrapped steel around the outside and then just reburied it. There's the entry. It goes into that door. There's another door 6 feet in, and there's another door 14 that goes into the room. And this is the interior of it at this point. It's all steel. There's lights. This was last year. We had 17,000. I figure I got about 22,000 pounds of stuff in there right now. This was getting ready for a Saturday market last year.
So this is obviously above the high water mark?
Yeah. There's no, where I am, there would never be any flooding. And once you thaw that ground out, it doesn't hold moisture at all, and it's so dry. USDA did a project where everybody's getting these high tunnels, so I got this 30 by 70 high tunnel last year, and I'm just totally impressed with it. And we actually just bought a 30 by 100 that got to Bethel yesterday when I was leaving, so I have to put that up when I get back. We grew strawberries in there this year. We put 400 plants in there and did really well with strawberries, and plan to put about 1,500 strawberries in this new one for next year. We don't have moose. Well, we're starting to get moose. We haven't had moose up to this point. There's moose coming back down there. I don't know. I don't think they would. I don't think they would. They're destructive like that. So this was actually May 5th. I took this picture of these strawberries I planted in April. And I'm sure these plants will come back this winter. It really doesn't, it seems to do what they say they're going to do, and I'm excited to see what these plants will do next year that over the winter in this building.
So they have heated beds.
Pardon me?
They have heated beds?
No, no. These are just on the ground with this big building over the top. There's no heat whatsoever in there. But I was surprised. You know, I didn't think I'd actually be able to do anything any earlier than I'm already doing anything. But I actually got to, I was in that building last March and running a rototiller in that ground, and it wasn't froze. So we did about 160 zucchini in this building, and really good seller. These are cucumbers were growing in that first building I showed you. We were getting about 30 to 50 every 3 days out of there. Tomatoes in the high tunnel. First year I've been able, this is a potato planter I built. I planted 14,000 potatoes this spring, and to do it with a bulb planter on your hands and knees would be hard. And I found this wagon wheel and put those metal points on it, and they poke holes in the ground, and then I had my wife sitting there dropping potatoes in the holes. But we could plant an acre in a day easy. So we covered all the potatoes. This is out at the airport with plastic. I had potatoes above ground by May 27th this year. And we left the plastic on probably till the end of July just because it was so cold. But my daughter and I'd go out every 3 or 4 days with a stick and a nail and just rip holes in the plastic where we see them starting to come up, and we let them grow up through the plastic all spring. But I think I'll stick with doing that. This is a potato harvester. It digs them out of the ground and lays them on the ground. Some peas we grew. Peppers did pretty good this year. Habaneros. Well, these are those turkeys. These turkeys I did last year, we killed them. I sold them for $100 a piece. Everybody that wanted to buy them came over Tuesday before Thanksgiving. I killed them. I had a big thing of water going. Everybody cleaned their own. And everybody really got into it. I got people fighting to get on the list this year. But actually, some of these birds were over 40 pounds when they were dressed out. And I got thinking, man, I must have kept these too long. So I got on the internet after Thanksgiving, and the industry typically kills their birds in 22 weeks. And we had kept these 21 weeks. And my wife and I kept the smallest hen we could find, and that thing even dressed out at 25 pounds. So I don't know why they were so big, but man, they were giant. So we got, that's our new problem now. These are 30 barred rock and Australorps we had last year. We bought 50 more layers this spring, and they're all just starting to lay here the other day. So my wife got like 62 eggs last night, and we got to figure out some way to wash them now. That's way too many eggs to wash in the sink, so I need some kind of a system for washing eggs. A commercial feed I buy out of Seattle. I don't do organic, but I do everything non-medicated. I bring it up 10, 12,000 pounds at a time. These are these steel frames that I built. I'm sure I'm running out of time here, huh? All right, well, quickly, worms underground, and there we are.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farm in Bethel, Alaska. Recorded on October 16th at UAA, Tim gave one of the keynote speeches at this year's Bioneers in Alaska conference. You can see photos of Tim's farm on alaskapublic.org. For the question and answer portion of the program, Tim was joined on stage by another keynote speaker at this year's Bioneers Conference, Karen Ivanoff, cultural anthropologist with Lake Clark National Park. If you missed Karen last week on Addressing Alaskans, you can hear her talk on Dena Ena Alena, a celebration, a window into Dena Ena culture, and see her photos and music at alaskapublic.org. This week, the Q&A will focus on the questions asked of Tim Myers following his talk on sustainable agriculture in rural Alaska.
Well, first, I just want to say that I think having these two speakers, the two of you here, is really important in having you side by side, because what I'm seeing is very important issues, two very important issues, and they sort of cross boundaries facing rural village Alaska. And there's sort of some differing cultural backgrounds, differing perspectives on things, I think. So this is kind of for both of you, but I think, Tim, regarding your project and being a pilot who's familiar with air transport and the dependency of air transport on air transport that villages have for most of their basic goods and services, how do you foresee your project shaping up as what many, many people and many analysts see as continually rising fuel costs, continually declining economy? And how do you see your production shaping up in the face of that? Because it seems very machine dependent to me. And to connect that with Karen and the Dena Ina people and all the villages, how do you foresee that dependency on the bush plane, bringing the goods and services, shaping up in the future? And to top that off, there's a lot of talk that I hear about some of the other villages embarking on their own horticultural, agricultural projects. Maybe each of you can comment on the feasibility of that. Thanks.
You know, we have the same situation on our watershed there. We got this Donlin Creek mine that's supposed to go in up above Crooked Creek there, that's on the Kuskokwim River. And I'm using that scenario quite a bit. I bring up agriculture, and I typically get, this isn't our culture, and it's usually not the culture that's saying it. It's the white man telling me that the native culture isn't into this agriculture, but our only alternative at this point is this mine. And I say, well, I don't think mining's that culture either. And there's a lot of negativeness on this mine happening up in our region also. And I keep saying, well, in the meantime, why don't we at least try to grow our own food? I mean, that would be a benefit if we could at least feed ourselves. So, and then the other point of view, just 3 or 4 days ago, NPR story, the bypass mail system getting attacked again. No one wants to pay the subsidy of, they mentioned, $6 billion a year to bring mail out to the villages. And I think $6 billion a year to buy fuel for planes to fly this low-quality food in, what, $1 million, we could put in a half dozen farms and probably cut the bypass mail in half? Kind of maybe something we should be able to talk about, I don't know.
This is a question for Tim. It's so exciting what you're doing. It's quite remarkable. I'm just wondering, are you selling all of what you produce in the Bethel region, or are you shipping some of what you sell out elsewhere?
Well, last year, I don't think people still really couldn't believe that I was doing this, and I was having a hard time getting rid of the quantities that I had, and I did send a lot of it into Natural Pantry last year. And I started this produce stand this spring, and it's just exploded. I mean, I don't think, I've got emails from all over the state. I got school districts now. I got, everybody wants to buy this local produce. And it was such a poor year. I really hope we don't do this again like that. But, you know, I just never, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to keep up with just the local demand. And my ultimate dream would be to be able to sell this organic produce all over the state.
So, like, is Rebecca going to work on, Rebecca's his daughter who lives down the street from me. I'm wondering if she's going to work on being your maybe Anchorage contact for getting some of your goods to an Anchorage market.
I would love her to take a lot of responsibility from me, but it just doesn't seem to be happening real quick.
Yeah. Thank you.
Individuals and collectively help you to keep those away from you so you can, you know, do what you really want to do in life instead of fighting the mines?
What I would say is, when I got started here a number of years ago, I saw this opportunity, I thought, and I tried to get other people interested. And I'm at the point where that energy that I use to get other people interested is much better spent on just doing what I do. And, you know, if you talk about funding sources, when I was doing the construction thing a number of years ago, there was a lot of interest in what I was doing. And when you start looking at other people's money, they all wanted me to, oh yeah, it's really neat that you can build these really affordable, efficient houses, but here's how you really do it, and you got to do it our way now because this is our money. So money from outside isn't always the best way, because you're going to be forced to go back to what we had done in the past, which we know doesn't work, so why continue to do that? And I'm really to the point where I'm just putting my nose down and let's get going. I see so much potential, and if there was interest in having this done elsewhere, I'd be happy to help, but I'm not putting forth any more effort to try to convince anybody this is what we need to be doing anymore.
Thanks to you both for coming. Alaska and all around the Arctic is changing along with the rest of the world, rest of the planet. And Tim, your work is, you know, astounding in a lot of ways, because so many people wouldn't expect you're doing what you're doing, where you're doing it. And Karen, you and your people have been doing what they are doing right where everyone should be expecting them to be doing it, just the way you should be expected to do it. But the planet's changing, and that's going to affect all of us, but it's going to affect, you know, Pebble, if Pebble ever happens, which it won't, hopefully. And it's going to affect agriculture and every plant, every growing thing, every living thing, you know, in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. So I'm just wondering, in addition to all of these political, economic, human-based things that you're dealing with, you know, energy and all of those things, what you think the planet's changing, and you can interpret that however you want, what you think the planet's changing is going to bring to the to what you're doing and to your home place?
Boy, you know, it's just nothing that I really quite, I'm still working on this concept of this changing economy, and I hadn't really gave the changing planet a lot of thought, but I do agree with you, it is changing. And basically where I've gone on this agriculture thing, it seems like the rest of everybody else is working on gardening projects, everybody's gardening, and I want to go one step farther and do farming, which is, I'm sure, a lot simpler than gardening. And the reason I'm headed this way is it's too late. I mean, it'd be nice if we could all have a garden, but we can't and we won't, and I think one farmer could feed many more people than a couple gardeners, but in reality, that's why we're in this problem. I mean, there's too many people because farming and agriculture has really taken our society into the situation we're in. So, I don't know, I really like what I'm doing, and I'm just keep going until we can't do this no more, I guess.
My question for Tim is, do you have any advice for those of us who want to be able to grow food for ourselves and maybe our neighbors, but we can't do what you do because we don't have electricity and tractors, and if we buried fish, the bears would come and dig up our gardens, and is it even sustainable for somebody like me who has to leave for fish camp and leave for moose hunting and stuff like that to try to grow food, like on a level, on a scale that would feed me for the winter.
Well, you mentioned fish camp there. Wouldn't you be able to do some of this at fish camp? I know a lot of people in our area all have gardens at fish camp, and there's so much benefit from being able to provide your own stuff. If there's a will, there's a way, I would think.
My name's Andre, and we live in a valley. We're fighting the coal mine with the Usabelli proposed coal mine and Wishbone Hill. But I want to make a really quick comments to both of you. Thank you very much for your programs and what you're doing. But Tim, you mentioned about you have no problem with the moose. Wait till it's find out how tasty your veggies are. Then you have the problem. This year we had the little garden in Palmer, and the moose came, cow with the little baby, and mow everything in 3 days.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Tim Myers, owner of Myers Farm in Bethel, Alaska. Tim responded to questions from the audience following his keynote address at this year's Bioneers in Alaska conference. His talk, entitled Sustainable Agriculture in Rural Alaska, was recorded at the University of Alaska Anchorage on October 16, 2011. You can see photos from Myers Farm on alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.